Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
The idea of regime change being affected from the air, it's got no precedent. Netanyahu and Trump's theory that Iranians will see the weakness of the regime and rush to replace it, I'm skeptical of all of that. I really am.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On the day the prosecution says Geoffrey McLean was killed, he played golf in the morning, went to the pub, and was messaging a friend in the afternoon until, all of a sudden, he stopped replying. I'm Stephen Stockwell, and just a warning, we'll be discussing some graphic scenes in this episode. This is episode 4 of the case of the Wheelie Bin murder.
A gruesome discovery on vacant land in Adelaide's north. Police say the remains belong to missing man Geoffrey McLean.
When Geoffrey's body was located, it had been dismembered. It was located in a wheelie bin.
Four people have been arrested in relation to his death.
A woman who's accused of murdering her ex-partner.
They're hopeful they can provide relief to his family.
Since our last episode, we've had a more complete picture of Geoffrey McLean put before the courts. This is a man whose torso ended up in a wheelie bin in a vacant lot, and we've learnt more about what happened to him before his death and also how he might have died. We're very lucky to have Eva Blandis back with us for this episode, ABC court reporter in Adelaide. Welcome, Eva.
Hi, Stocky.
Eva, it's been a little while since we've caught up. Could you take us through some of the key evidence before we jump into this episode?
Yeah, so the last little while we've heard a lot from police who attended at those assaults that we've heard about before. Those are the assaults before the alleged murder. So there are three different assaults. We also heard from the friend who last had communication with Geoffrey McLean on the day the prosecution alleged he died or was killed. We've also heard from the pathologist who looked at his torso once that wheelie bin was discovered, and we've heard some of his theories as to what happened.
Thank you, Eva. Very much looking forward to diving into what we've learned about Geoffrey McLean's cause of death in this episode as well. I mean, it's such a brutal murder that we are discussing in this podcast. And yeah, the way that Geoffrey McLean's body was found in the wheelie bin is, you know, kind of horrific. And I'm keen to understand a little bit about why we have to go into this kind of detail in court as well throughout this episode. So we'll come to that a little bit later in the ep. But first, I'm keen to kind of step back. Eva, as you mentioned in our first episode, we heard about these previous assaults on Geoffrey McLean. Now, he had been living with Cherie Glastonbury at this point, and one night a man breaks in and hits him in the head with a log splitter, which is like a really kind of thick axe. It is a brutal attack. Geoffrey McLean survives that. Police attend the house. They come up to Cherie Glastonbury's property. What do they find?
We actually got a really good description of what this scene was like and what it was like for the police who first arrived. So they come to the door. Cherie Glastonbury answers. Geoffrey McLean then comes to the door as well. He comes out of the bedroom at the front of the house. They're obviously explaining what's happened. Geoffrey McLean is obviously injured, so he's instructed to go sit down in the lounge room. We've heard that there was blood found on the inside of the wooden door. There was blood in the hallway smeared on the walls, and there was also blood in that lounge room as well. So there was a lot going on in this scene, and we really did get a colourful description of it.
Yeah. How is Geoffrey McLean in this moment? He's just been hit in the head with a log splitter, like I described, you know, kind of almost like a cross between a sledgehammer and an axe. Is he all right?
Yeah, well, we didn't actually hear anything about how he was. We did, though, hear from the police officer who was first on scene in his cross-examination by Cherie's lawyer. We did hear that Cherie appeared frantic.
Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty confronting scene, I imagine. We heard in the openings that the prosecution alleges someone comes into that house and, yeah, while Geoffrey McLean is sleeping on the couch in part of it, has a log splitter kind of thrust into the side of his head, which would be, pretty confronting. I mean, we have so much evidence relating to this interaction being presented to the court. There's a lot of police witnesses that are kind of the ones who were talking through this, as you described. You know, we had the police officer who gets to the house and takes us through this scene. How is all this evidence being presented to the court and shown to the jury?
So we're getting a lot of police officers coming to give evidence. So they're usually the people who are first on scene or crime investigators. So they're sort of able to set that scene. And with them coming to give evidence, they're also having documents tendered through them. So these may be photos of the scene. It may be body-worn vision from their body cams. And then those photos, when they're tendered through these witnesses, they're given to the jury. So the jury can then reference them and they sort of get that bundle of photographs. There's no book, so to speak. It's just more of a bundle of photographs and they keep them for the rest of the trial. So they can go back to them whenever they want to.
Gotcha. And they've got, it's like physical copies of this. I know in the trial of Aaron Patterson, the jury was using iPads and, you know, documents would be kind of uploaded and pushed to the iPad throughout the trial. In this trial, it's like physical documents kind of being handed to the jury. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Really, we're in that stage at the moment in the trial where we've got all of that sort of that starting point, all of that stuff tendered just to sort of help, I think, set a scene and get the jury to understand what they're dealing with.
Yeah, and in this instance, you know, when we're looking at the house of Cherie Glastonbury, who is the woman accused of murdering Geoffrey McLean, along with Mark Murphy, also accused of murdering Geoffrey McLean, what evidence is being tendered here? Are we getting, you know, body-worn footage of the police walking through this house? Are we getting crime scene photos? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we're getting some body-worn, but the majority of what is being tendered at the moment are those crime scene photographs, and there's a lot of them. We also have to remember, you know, when these people are taking these photos, they don't know what's going to be relevant. So there are a lot of miscellaneous photos of, you know, all sorts of random things. We spoke about in one of our last episodes that there was a stormtrooper in one of the rooms. So obviously that's not relevant that we know of, but, you know, there are a lot of photos to go through to sort of set the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess crime scene investigators trying to capture the entirety of that because, yeah, as you say, they've got no idea what may or may not be important later down the track. I mean, there was a lot of conversation about the log splitter at this point of the trial. There was all this talk about who touched it, who moved it. What was going on here? What was being talked about?
So the police officer was questioned about where he saw the log splitter. He was also questioned about whether he touched it or moved it. Then we also heard the forensics expert being questioned about that too, whether he touched it or moved it, where he saw it, and where the photos that he'd taken of it showed that log splitter.
Interesting, because, I mean, we heard in the openings that the prosecution alleges that Cherie Glastonbury did move or did at least touch the log splitter at some point after Geoffrey McLean had been hit in the head with it. The prosecution's allegation is that Cherie Glastonbury had enlisted Mark Murphy, also accused of the murder of Geoffrey McLean, to hit Geoffrey McLean with the log splitter. And after Geoffrey McLean had been taken to hospital, Cherie Glastonbury allegedly re-enters the house unattended by police. And then when she emerges, as we've kind of heard discussed here, prosecution allegation is that the log splitter is in a different location. You know, I guess through the various evidence that would have been presented, the jury gets a look at where the log splitter was, you know, potentially on the body cam footage of one of the police officers and then in the photos of the forensics guy who was going through the house. So, yeah, really interesting to hear kind of how that unfolded in court, Eva. I mean, you know, knowing that that's a point that the prosecution is getting into and is alleging because of its openings, I mean, was there much cross-examination of the witnesses around this evidence?
So there's been a little bit from the defence. We're mainly hearing from Cherie Glastonbury's lawyer as well as Mark Murphy's lawyers. We heard some cross-examination of a police officer who attended the scene when Geoffrey McLean's car was set on fire. So this is sort of a separate little incident. She was cross-examined by Cherie Glastonbury's lawyer, Mari Shaw, who asked why she hadn't saved her body-worn footage. So there was a bit about that and about the fact that, yes, she likely would have had it on, but if you don't save it, you know, that day or that morning, then you can't recover it.
Right.
So there was a few questions about that, and about how you don't have a sort of an actual videoed conversation with these people on that day. Mm. So it's just her recollection rather than that video footage.
Yeah, got it. Eva, in our last episode, we were talking about one of Jeffrey McLean's friends. It was the first time I'd really heard much about who he was. I mean, we've talked kind of a lot about him, but something I notice when we're covering trials like this is often the victim does get a bit lost because you're talking kind of about elements of them so much and not so much about who they were as a person. And we did hear from another one of his friends over the last week, someone who's actually known him for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, so we heard from Stuart Capagna, who's known Jeffrey or knew Jeffrey for about 15 to 16 years. They'd met while playing golf, and he called him by the nickname Macca. So it was, yeah, quite nice to sort of get more of a picture of who Jeffrey was through a long-term friend of his.
Yeah. What did we hear from Stuart Capagna? Where did he, what sort of evidence was he giving? What was he being asked about?
So he was mainly talking about that last day that Jeffrey McLean was seen alive. So we talked about that, I think it was in the last episode. Mm. So he joined him and his other friend and played golf that morning on August 18th, 2022. Mm. He did also say that he saw Jeffrey McLean take meth that day through an ice pipe. So we had previously heard that Jeffrey's behaviour became a little bit more erratic and his other friend assumed that's what had happened. Mm. Then they sort of go their separate ways. So we heard before that Jeffrey McLean went to the Mawson Lakes Hotel. So Stuart Capagna didn't go there. So they separate, but they're in contact throughout that afternoon.
Right. Okay.
And there are quite a lot of messages over that afternoon. It's all about Jeffrey McLean trying to buy some meth, and there's mm-hmm. talk about bank account details, and there are calls and there are texts. So there's a lot going on in that period.
Right. And so Jeffrey McLean is, you know, Stuart must be a contact of his or someone he uses to buy meth. And so he's messaging Stuart basically saying, hey, look, can you get me some meth? What are your bank details? I'll send you the money, et cetera, et cetera. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, so there's that back and forth about drugs.
Yeah. How long does it go for?
So there's about 4 hours-ish of that back and forth about trying to buy those drugs. There's an ongoing conversation there, and then it just sort of stops.
Oh. Just nothing. Had they resolved? Had he bought the drugs at that point?
No. So we actually got to the point we heard that Stuart Capagna was almost home to get his bank account details to send to Jeffrey for then Jeffrey to send the money. Mm. And the last communication they had was just before Stuart got home. And then by the time he was ready to give that information, Jeffrey was not responding.
And the prosecution is alleging this is the point where Jeffrey McLean is murdered, right? Is this the window they're pointing to?
Yeah, so this is the window they're pointing to. So he's last seen at that hotel, and then the last communication that he has with Stuart Capagna or with anyone that we know of is at 4:45 that afternoon.
Right. Does Stuart try to raise him at all? Does he, like, keep messaging back, try to call him or anything?
Yeah, so he last hears from Jeffrey at 4:45. So that's the last time we actually hear from him. Mm. He then tries to call Jeffrey at 4:52 p.m. and gets nothing. He then tries over and over again trying to get in touch with him, whether that's through text message or call. There are a few voice messages left, but he gives up about 8 o'clock.
Yeah, incredible to kind of get that detail, I suppose, from the last person to have communication with Jeffrey McLean before his death. He's not seen again until his body is found in a wheelie bin in a vacant lot a couple of months later. If we spoke a bit about the kind of the state of Jeffrey McLean's body in our last episode when we were hearing from some of the forensic folk who were tasked with, you know, examining the evidence in the wheelie bin when it was taken back to be kind of investigated and, you know, learned a bit more about. We've now heard from the man who examined the body of Jeffrey McLean. This is the forensic pathologist. This would not have been a pleasant job.
No, quite gruesome. So Neil Langlois, he's a forensic pathologist. So he was that one that looked at that wheelie bin and really examined it quite closely. Mm. We heard him describe the weight of the wheelie bin being 85 kilos. Now, to keep in mind, the weight of the torso was 62 kilos.
Right.
The body was really badly decomposed, as we've heard, and there were a lot of decomposition fluids. So there was a lot going on in that bin. And he also mentioned there were some maggots because, as we know, that body had been in that bin for a very long time out in the elements. So, yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah, yeah. 2 months between Jeffrey McLean going missing and this body being recovered in the vacant lot. Yeah, long time for the body to be sitting in that bin. And, I mean, Eva, we talk about things like decomposition fluids, which is not a word I thought I would be ever having to really say at all. The detail in this is so gruesome. It is really full on. I mean, why is this stuff that is being put before the jury at all?
It's important for the jury to sort of understand the whole scene, and you never know what's going to be important or what the jury might think is important. And as we know anyway, and we've heard in previous episodes, Justice Kimber is very, very understanding that that this is not a nice thing for the jury to hear. So there is sort of still that standing invitation for any of those jurors to put their hand up and take a moment to sort of gather themselves if it's too gruesome.
Yeah, okay, great. I might take advantage of that at some point as well if I ever feel like we're going a little bit too gruesome.
Yes.
But I feel like I've kind of been steeled for where we're going to go next, and I'm braced to kind of learn a bit about what we heard from this forensic pathologist. What did he tell the jury? What was he able to learn about the body of Jeffrey McLean?
So it was quite difficult, as you can imagine, but he said he was able to conclude that Jeffrey McLean's head was severed from roughly halfway down his neck. Now, he wasn't able to say whether it was cut off while Jeffrey was alive or after he was killed because of the decomposition. So it made it quite difficult, but he also said that the arms were cut from the top of the biceps and the legs were severed from around the mid-height of the thigh. So, again, same thing, can't conclude if that was before or after death, but he was able to make the conclusion that it would require a sawing motion to make those cuts, whether dead or alive.
Okay, yeah, right. Was it hard for him to do much with the body in such an advanced state of decomposition?
Yeah, it sounded like it. He said he wasn't able to get much blood from the torso, but he was able to get a small amount from his heart and the remains of the legs.
What was he able to find out? I mean, obviously not much blood, so it's going to, I guess, imagine being a challenge for kind of toxicology results and things like that. Was he able to learn much at all from what he had?
Yeah, so there wasn't enough blood there to check for the drugs, any drugs in his system.
Right.
But he was able to take a sample from his liver, and from that sample there was some meth in there, about 1.3 milligrams per kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
There was also some diazepam and some nordiazepam.
Right, okay, got it.
But he said there was no information to say that insulin contributed to Jeffrey McLean's death. He said the only thing that they could submit to see whether there was insulin in his system would be the vitreous humour of the eyes. So that is, of course, not available in this case, as we only had Jeffrey McLean's torso. So there was no way to confirm or exclude that insulin was the cause.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, no head, no arms, no legs, just the torso, which is what this examination was on. Even that insulin reference is kind of interesting. I mean, we heard a little bit about insulin in the openings. Is that where this is coming from?
Yeah, so in the prosecution opening, we heard that it will be alleged that a bag of insulin pens were found at Sheree Glastonbury's house. So this was during one of the police searches. I think it was from memory, it was in her kitchen. So we've sort of just got some details about there ever being a presence of insulin in this case, and then just that line of questioning, but we're yet to hear any evidence about those pens.
Yeah, we also heard in openings about some kind of secret recordings that the police did on the house of Mark Murphy and Peter Murphy. Mark Murphy also accused of the murder of Jeffrey McLean, and Peter Murphy accused of assisting an offender. That's Mark Murphy's twin brother. Were they talking about insulin as well?
Yeah, so these recordings, these listening devices which were allegedly put in their house, we are yet to hear those recordings, but we did hear in the opening that the prosecution will allege that there were discussions about the breakdown of insulin.
This feels like a whole bunch of loose threads, but I feel like also in the openings there was a reference to a hot shot as well. Is that something to do with insulin too?
So in the opening, it was alleged that Cherie Glastonbury had spoken to her cellmate about how the cause of death may have been determined from the torso alone and why dismemberment may have occurred. She allegedly commented that cutting off the arms would be so you can't tell if someone has been given a hot shot. Again, this evidence hasn't been brought before the jury yet, but this is what the prosecution alleged in their opening.
Right. Okay, got it. Thank you. If you're listening to this and you're a little bit confused about it, don't worry. I think everyone probably is a little bit confused about it.
Yes.
Including the jury. There's a lot to unfold in this trial still, and just wanted to make sure that you had all the context of basically insulin reference or any kind of like drug overdose references as well that we've heard from so far to kind of have that clear in your mind. I mean, Eva, we had this forensic pathologist, you know, examining Jeffrey McLean's body. What did he determine around cause of death?
He wasn't actually able to determine anything, really. He was able to find that he had aortic stenosis. He can't exclude the possibility that Jeffrey died of it, but he said he found it's more likely he died with it than of it. So we were able to hear a little bit about that, but as we heard, that there wasn't a lot there to work with, so it was really hard to make any solid conclusion.
Mm, yeah, I mean, we're talking about the body of someone who's been in a weather bin for weeks at this point, right? So would not have been a lot that I suppose the pathologist could have done with that. Eva, appreciate you taking us all the way through that as well. We do have some questions that are coming in to the case law at abc.net.au. Most of the questions about the case of the Wheeler Bin murder are, when is the next episode of the case of the Wheeler Bin murder? So pleased to be able to answer that one with just an entire episode of this series. So hopefully we've quenched your thirst with this episode. Eva, we do have a bunch of other ones that I'm keen to get into though. First one here from Ellen. Ellen's from Melbourne and writes in just asking about our repeated use of the term tumultuous to describe what sounds like a history of family violence between the deceased and the accused. Ellen asks, are you relying on this language because it is what is arising / being used in court? Ellen, that is pretty much where I'm getting it from. Yeah, so that is the word that has been used by the prosecution to describe the relationship between Cherie Glastonbury and Jeffrey McLean. And they've also, as we've mentioned, you know, referenced other police attendances at the property as well. So that one point where police attended, or prosecution alleges that police attended and saw bruises on Cherie Glastonbury at that point. Is there anything you've been thinking or had thoughts on around that?
Just sort of that, yes, that's the term we've heard said by the prosecution. So we're also using that term, and that's as far as we can go at the moment.
Eva, another one here. This falls into a category I like to refer to as more of a statement. Usually we're asking for people to send in questions to the case of at abc.net.au, but reflections and thoughts are also very welcome, and that is one that we have here from Bernhardt, who's written in from Hindmarsh Island. He writes, just in case it's of interest to anyone, Justice Kimber, who's the judge presiding over this case, played two games of God's great and glorious game, otherwise known as cricket, for South Australia in the Sheffield Shield 30 years ago. Bernhard helpfully notes that he is a quick tragic, in case there was any question about that from the fact that he has presented to the case of. So, Bernhard, really appreciate you getting in touch with such a wonderful fact. We all now know a little bit more about Justice Kimber, and we'll be sending the lawyers to you if this somehow prejudices this trial, which hopefully it doesn't, because the jury hasn't heard it, but I feel like it's kind of not relevant at all. So we'll see how we go. If you have a question or a thought, please get in touch. You can write to us at thecaseof@abc.net.au. Eva is here, ready and waiting to answer all questions about the case of the Wheeler Bin murder. We also have Liz and James ready and waiting to answer any questions around the case of the two intruders. You're all fully aware of my very complicated filing system, four emails, so nothing will get lost. So please get in touch. Eva, what have we got coming up next? Where are we going next in the case of the Wheeler Bin murder?
So we're going to be hearing some more about those alleged attacks before Jeffrey's disappearance, and then we will hopefully eventually get to those listening devices that were put in the home of Peter and Mark Murphy. So we're sort of getting into more of that sort of stuff, which will be very, very interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to exploring that a little bit more as well. You know, this case and this trial is not without its delays, as we've talked about in our last episode, in the ceremonial courtroom or one of the bigger courtrooms in Adelaide that occasionally gets used for other purposes. So coming and going a little bit from the case of the Wheelie Bin murder at the moment, but endeavouring to have you episodes probably once a fortnight or so. And in the meantime, back in your feed with episodes of The Case of the Two Intruders. So make sure you grab yourself ABC Listen. It is the best place to listen to The Case Of, as well as a whole bunch of other wonderful ABC content. If you're not using ABC Listen, if you're using another third-party podcast platform, please leave us a rating and a review. It makes it so much easier for people to find us, and we'll be back in your feed on Thursday with an episode of The Case of the Two Intruders. The Case of the Wheelie Bin Murder is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by Eva Blandis and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Kaurna and Wurundjeri people.